Yes, they should.
My green specialist that's also here. I changed the insurance companies.
Call the House Committee on Healthcare to order for this April 5th and open up a public hearing on House Bill 3418. Madam Administrator, what do we have?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, 3418 modifies the methodology for reimbursement of the healthcare services and supplies provided to enrollees in health benefit plans offered by the Public Employees Benefit Board.
Madam Speaker.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Tina Kotek, State Representative, House District 44, North and Northeast Portland. Speaker of the House, good to be with you today to talk about House Bill 3418. This is one piece of a broader conversation about how to reduce cost drivers within our state budget. Specifically, this bill seeks to contain the cost of providing health care services to our state employees. Health plans offered through the Public Employees Benefit Board cover over 136,000 state employees, spouses, and children. Since 2013, the legislature has aimed to keep these costs in check by capping the annual cost growth for health insurance plans in PEB to 3.4%. The PEB board has generally done well to adhere to this cost trend through annual insurance contract negotiations, but I think we can do better, particularly on the provider side. So this bill would formalize the effort to contain the rate of insurance cost increases by instituting reasonable guardrails on our health insurance costs in PEP. The bill does two primary things. It sets a maximum allowable cost for in-network claims at 200% of Medicare, and it sets a maximum allowable cost for out-of-network claims at 185% of Medicare. The current average inpatient-outpatient cost for the self-insured plans is approximately 237% of Medicare. The bill targets 200% for in-network claims because it's an achievable benchmark that still moves us in the right direction. The bill would apply to both our self-insured and fully insured plans in PEB. The maximum, and I want to emphasize that, the maximum allowable costs would apply to inpatient and outpatient costs and specialty care claims. It would not apply to type A, type B, or critical access hospitals, primary care services, behavioral health homes, or any other claim that could be included in a primary care incentive program. I also want to be clear that House Bill 3418 does not prohibit incentive payments or value-based payments to improve outcomes. It simply defines a ceiling. The goal is to increase transparency in specific healthcare costs, set expectations for how prices are set, and ultimately reduce the cost of providing healthcare services to state employees. We can see the need for this measure by looking at a few key data points that support the findings of a recent Quality Corp study, which I know the committee reviewed a couple weeks ago. And that study found the cost of health care in Oregon is 17% higher than neighboring states with no correlating increase in the quality of care. So I want to give you some numbers specifically about PEB as they relate to the percentage of Medicare. In 2016, there was a 8.1% increase in medical costs across all PEB plans compared to the previous plan year, 8%. Mercer actuaries determined that 3.4%, oddly enough, same number, but 3.4% of the self-insured cost increases were due to simple increases in the service cost, not increases in utilization or risk. For example, based on aggregate data of services and procedures, which, by the way, we provide aggregate and anonymous in terms of whose numbers they are on OLISH. You'll see a list of the aggregate data of services and procedures. You can review those. The state is paying up to 672% of Medicare to some hospitals. 672% of Medicare. The number of cesarean sections across regions, so we'll just look at one type of treatment. In cesarean sections across regions, we decreased in the number of them from 2.1 to 0.1 per thousand from 2014 to 2016, so a two-year change. Yet the minimum allowed paid claim from PEB increased from over $6,300 to over $11,000 for the same time period. This is an increase of 84% in cost, with a decrease of 200% in utilization. So this idea that the cost and utilization are linked is not borne out by the data that we have. Here's another type of treatment, catheter utilization. Also, guiding catheter utilization did not increase between 2014 and 2016, yet the cost of this procedure increased 113% since 2015 and varied dramatically between regions. So we don't have consistency, we don't have connection to utilization, and I would argue not connection to quality as well. So with those data points in mind, it's clear that House Bill 3418 could both increase transparency in pricing and result in considerable cost savings. A preliminary model of potential cost savings just for inpatient and outpatient hospital claims, and this builds broader than that, but just for the inpatient and outpatient hospital claims, at 200% of Medicare, we found that PEB could save over $30 million per year on the self-insured plan. House Bill 3418 provides a meaningful and achievable way to follow through on our commitment to reduce the cost drivers in our state budget. So I urge your consideration of this bill and be happy to answer questions after I follow my co-sponsor. Thank you, Mr.
Chair. Thank you. Please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Oregon State Representative Greg Smith, and I have the distinct pleasure of representing District 57, which is in eastern Oregon, Umatilla County, Morrow County, Gillum County, Sherman County, and the very, very best parts of Wasco County. Mr. Chair, thank you for allowing me to be here. Colleagues, I want to give just a little bit of background. I've been in the legislature for 9 terms. Primarily focused in ways and means, and I currently serve as the vice co-chair of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. And I feel as if I have a broad understanding of the state budget, how it operates, and particularly opportunity cost. And when I talk about opportunity cost, it means that we can only spend a dollar one time. And the question is how are we going to do that? And I'm pleased to support House Bill 3418 and Speaker Kotek in this effort, because I absolutely believe that if we could advance this piece of legislation, it's going to result in savings that we can then put into our education system, perhaps into our state troopers, perhaps into our senior citizens. Let me give a little more thought on this, or share a little more thought on this. In order for our state to be on a path to a stable financial future, the legislature must continue working to find efficiencies and opportunity to contain costs. One of those opportunities is within PEB. PEB offers both self-insured and fully insured plans. Self-insured plans receive an administrative fee per employee per month, and PEB pays all claim costs. Fully insured plans are paid a monthly premium by PEB and must cover all claim costs internally through the plan. Providence offers 2 products to employees, PEB Statewide and Providence Choice. You folks know that. Both plans are self-insured products, and I want to underline self-insured. This means PEB pays Providence an administrative fee per employee per month. On the front end, Providence administers and pays the claims, but it is reimbursed by PEB for claim costs. Under this arrangement, PEB takes on the risk of claim costs. When costs come in higher than expected, PEB takes a loss. When costs are under expectation, PEB adds the excess to its reserves. PEB pays for premiums on fully insured plans. Any increase in costs or total claims paid could result in premium increase requests, driving up the cost of PEB in whole. Preliminary enrollment numbers for the 2017 year plan year show 72.5% of PEB subscribers are enrolled in one of the 2 Providence self-insured plans. For the 2016 plan year, we saw a 6.8% increase in paid medical claims in self-insured plans only. 3.4% of this was attributed to cost, the actual per unit per procedure price paid for services. We saw a similar trend for PEB's fully insured plans, resulting in a total increase of medical claims across both fully and self-insured plans in the amount of 8.1%. Colleagues, the state needs to commit to being a smart shopper. That's just the facts. As a consumer of services, in this case health insurance services, we should always be looking for ways to get the same quality for a lower price. This bill not solely This bill, I believe, is going to help us move in that direction. This is not solely due to utilization or risk. High variance and increased cost of services are driving up expenses. We believe the state has authority over the plan design of its employees, and we can determine what we pay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I'd also like to make a brief comment before we go further and ask your questions. I serve as the body's representative on the PEB board now, and I've been doing that now for a couple of months. And part of my job is to point out to them that they have to keep their costs at a 3.4 maximum. But what I haven't been able to say to them is, here's how you can do it. And this is very much a very timely bill and very important, and will really give the board a tool to keeping their costs under responsibility. And I hope we'll be able to move this very quickly. Are there any questions?
Yes,
Representative Buehler.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Gumsich. Madam Speaker, it's sad to me that we have moved from a place in Oregon where innovation and delivery system reform was the way we cut cost and really made our mark in Oregon to price control. Why are you such a proponent of price controls? Where's the evidence to support that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Buehler, can you explain to me why price controls are at least what we're asking for in here and increased transparency and connecting to a stated methodology for setting prices is somehow counter to innovation?
I'm asking you the questions.
Well, I guess I don't believe it's counter to innovation, so can you explain to me why it is?
That wasn't the question. The question is, why are you such a proponent of price controls?
Well, what I'm a proponent of, Mr. Chair and Representative Buehler, is cost containment. And this is not counter to transformation, is not counter to innovation. I think it's what it's saying is we as a state and the 136,000 lives that we cover have to get the best deal for the state. Nothing in this bill says we can't show innovation from the plans. It sets a ceiling of 200% of Medicare reimbursement for services. There's nothing keeping plans in PEB from pursuing value-based work. They've been doing that. Providence does it as our TPA. In fact, we in the self-insured plans, as I mentioned, the average is 237% of Medicare. The majority, vast majority of what happens in the PEB plans, who tell us they get the best price and are following value-based pricing and quality, even in their primary care home model. They can do this. Therefore, everyone should be doing this. We get more quality and we get better pricing.
Follow up?
Right.
So I'll give you the point based on your opinion, not any economic evidence that price control work. So assuming price control work, why are we only signaling out a very small percentage of PEB payments for price control? Why not hospitals or mental health providers or lab and x-ray that's so effective?
Mr. Chair and Representative Buehler, because I think that is consistent with the triple aim, which is to focus on prevention and to focus on reducing costs, especially in hospital care, which we are trying to prevent with behavioral services, preventative care, primary care. So I don't, would you argue we should?
Did you say hospitals aren't included?
Yes,
hospitals are included.
No. Yes, it's everything that's basically not primary care.
That's not what you said in your comments. That's not what it says in the bill.
Could you help me point out which part of the bill that is while I look for it? It's all claims except primary care.
Maybe I'm looking at an old version.
And there was an early version. This is 3418, so.
That had hospitals also.
That was just hospital. And we felt that it should be everything but primary care.
It says, at least the version I have, it says this section.
Oh, this is a
doesn't
matter,
apply
this
to the
matter
type
of fact.
It does not apply to type A or B hospitals.
Oh, the A or B hospitals.
Or rural critical access hospitals.
Right.
So it's a DRG
because they have
hospital.
A different cost structure, Mr. Chair. I would. That's why they're not in there.
So either it does or doesn't. Is this applied to
the
A
and B hospitals?
It doesn't include
DRG
the
hospital.
Right.
It does or does not?
It does apply to DRG hospitals.
All DRGs.
It says not type A or type B hospitals.
Yes.
Not rural critical access hospitals.
Right. Correct, Mr. Chair, Representative Buell, because we believe they have different reimbursement structures, so they're not included. Neither are on the back side of the bill on page 2, patient-centered primary care home, which I think is consistent with transformation and innovation and behavioral health homes and primary care home payment models.
We're going to have lots of testimony on this bill. We have a couple more members waiting to testify on another one. So why don't we excuse you, and we'll deal with these issues as we go forward.
And I apologize that it cannot remain, but I'd be happy to follow up, you know, if there are direct questions after I have to go. So thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Committee members.
And Mr. Chair, I need to return back to Ways and Means. Thank you very much for this opportunity to participate in this bill. Thank you, Madam Speaker.
We'll,
and I'm going to return to committee.
We'll substitute a couple of pale alternatives for the two of you by opening up a hearing on House Bill 3341.
Yes.
Hospital 3341. And ask Representative Hurd and Representative Meek to join us.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3341 establishes an 11-member task force on rural medical training facilities. It directs the task force to investigate issues relating to alleviating the shortage of skilled and experienced nurses and medical technicians in or near Douglas County.
You might just have you. Well?
I'll do my best.
You'll do without a wingman.
We'll give him a quick call.
Please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Dallas Hurd, representative of House District 2, primarily the Roseburg and Douglas County area. And I just want to say how grateful I am that you've allowed us to have our bill heard today, and I hope we'll be able to move this on. So, colleagues, I'm here to talk about the task force for this medical, the Allied Healthcare Medical Technical Training Project in Roseburg. So, because there's quite a bit of details to this, I'm going to stick to my notes. So, bear with me. This bill would establish a task force with the goal of locating an academic partner with bachelor, graduate level, and PhD level accreditation for this Allied Healthcare Medical Training Facility project in Roseburg. The Dash 3 amendments place a member from the Roseburg VA on the task force, has the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs staff the task force, clarifies language that the task force can discuss veterans reintegration issues, as we see this partnership with the VA as an invaluable asset, and allows the task force to vote on including the proper academic partner as a member once they have been identified by the task force as willing to make the investment in this project. Although this project has been discussed for years, this approach is brand new. And some folks that have come here today, Mr. Chair, are going to... There's some folks here from the local community that are going to expand on how the new part of the project has kind of come to the table with the national VA system, how that's getting a lot of traction going in a good direction. The federal VA now...
I'm going to ask them to not expand too much about it, and we'll just move your bill along.
You know... I'll shut up right now.
No, you don't. It's the sort of, you got 9 votes, don't go for 8.
Yeah. Could we pass that information on to Chair Holvey for some other bills? Okay. Anyway, the federal VA now has high interest in developing this project. Many returning veterans seeking reintegration are looking to utilize their GI Bill benefits in the medical field. This project is the first in the U.S. to create such a partnership. It addresses the Oregonians for Rural Health Workforce 2024 projections, which forecast a shortage in med tech practitioners. This project will give all of Oregon the ability to meet the med tech professionals' needs with an educated, skilled workforce ready to work and serve in Oregon. Furthermore, the proximity to Roseburg's VA will provide invaluable experience for Oregon students. Quickly, I'm going to hit on my community where this project is focused to be created. The Roseburg-Douglas County area is a place that I've called home for my entire life and much of my family since the late 1800s. It's a proud community. It's, as I so fondly have put it on my moniker on the House floor, it's the timber capital of the world. But the fact remains is that over the last several decades, my community has been largely stripped of its legacy, its natural resources through poor federal management of our forests, and a lot of our dignity has been stripped away as well. Growing up in my community, I can remember just 15, 16 years ago, it was very different. We have slipped into a lot of dependency on methamphetamines and a lot of different other drugs that are continuing to work in our community, because as your economy falls apart and jobs go away and opportunity goes away, a lot of folks leave. A lot of folks that stay behind become very depressed and discouraged, and it's just difficult to not see the evils of the world start to creep into your once proud community. We've gone from being what I considered the Alabama of high school football to just barely hanging on. And to some folks, that might not be that big of a deal. But for someone like myself, who grew up idolizing Roseburg football and Douglas County football, for that matter, we've had some great legends in the sport, like Troy Polamalu, who came from Douglas High School, and a lot of other folks that have gone into the collegiate and professional level. And right now, we're just barely hanging on. And we need something to radically change the current direction we're on from an economic outlook. And I believe this project is going to be a massive step in the right direction. And my community is willing to step up with the state to pursue this project and get things rolling. So I'll continue. This task force, once it finds an academic partner, will set in motion a project that will ultimately not just uplift my community through ancillary service economy like many other college towns. Large educational facilities bring a student population our local economy needs. This project will reduce VA wait times as these allied health med tech students get hands-on experience working in partnership with the Roseburg VA, reducing the staff shortage for quicker turnaround and better health care for our veterans by utilizing these medical students in clinical rotations at the VA hospital and other local area hospitals throughout the Southern Oregon region. More than just keeping a community healthy, this will give our community back its sense of purpose and identity. Again, this bill simply asks the state to partner with our current efforts, not to do it for us, but to work alongside us to create a task force to find the academic partner who can provide bachelor, graduate, and PhD level accreditation for medical technicians in Roseburg. As the federal VA is excited about this project, I would like to see the state of Oregon become excited about the first in the nation education approach as well. My community is seeking a renewing of hope, and this project is that hope. I appreciate your support.
Thank you.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, my name is Mark Meek, representative for House District 40, Oregon City, Gladstone, and unincorporated Clackamas County area. And I thank you for hearing this bill today, House Bill 3341. And I'm proud to be one of the sponsors on this very important and exciting bill, both as a state representative and as a veteran. Oregon's health care needs continue to grow, yet healthcare providers are struggling to expand services due to workforce shortages, particularly in allied health fields. I applaud the collaborative efforts that are underway in Douglas County, where the community has come together to support veterans and solve a workforce shortage problem. It is exciting to see this effort involve the VA, regional healthcare providers, local governments, community colleges, and economic development groups. This effort has the potential to charter new territory in regard to reintegration strategies for veterans who are transitioning to civilian life. In addition to reintegration support, this partnership would have a positive impact on the area of workforce development in Oregon. As a veteran, I know firsthand the process of being discharged from active duty and the difficulty of transitioning back into the civilian life and finding that new job, getting back into the workforce, trying to continue my education. And so while veterans earn GI benefits to go to college, there's no real direction provided or any post-service programs to help guide veterans towards these opportunities, both in higher education, professional development, or to identify where their skills that they developed in the military can translate into civilian life. What is exciting about this effort, though, is that it can give veterans with medical training a path to expand upon their skills and enter into civilian healthcare jobs. Passing this bill will demonstrate the state's support for this important effort to address growing healthcare workforce shortage and to support recession-proof economic development strategies for rural Oregon. So House Bill 3341 is an opportunity for Oregon to lead the nation with an innovative approach to veterans reintegration, tough word, that could be a precedent-setting model. Furthermore, expanding health care training can reverse workforce shortages, expand health care services, and provide more family wage jobs for hardworking Oregon families. So I thank you for your consideration on this bill.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. Have a couple of folks that's driven a long way to give some testimony. We'll invite them up now.
Thank you, Chair Green. Thank you, committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We'll be working this bill as soon as we're done. By order of the President of the Senate and the Speaker of the House, everything that has a task force goes to Ways and Means, but this has no general fund fiscal. I think we want to make sure we're getting it out of Ways and Means over to the Senate. And would you please call the next two witnesses?
Thank you.
Wayne Patterson and Barbara Galbraith.
First?
Yes, please.
Thank you, Chair and committee. This is thank you for the invite. I'd like to make my side of the presentation.
Please introduce yourself.
I'm sorry, Wayne Patterson. I'm the executive director for the Office for Economic Development in Douglas County. Our office is largely funded by the county and the city of Roseburg. This project, this college, falls through my office as a primary responsibility. So that's my representation. We're economic development. And one of the things I'd like to do is the presentation that was given before gave a lot of details. So let me kind of try to add on to what was not covered instead of kind of covering that over again. So when I came on board a little over a year ago, the challenge was that the allied health and mental health kind of college idea that was born was really to fulfill a need in Southern Oregon. It really didn't include the VA at that time. And what they had done is they had come up with an assessment of being able to look at these what we call advanced degree positions in the health industry in Southern Oregon and felt that there was a significant need there to be able to do something rural. So one of the problems in rural Oregon is when you go talk to the hospitals, they have a retention factor after 3 years of about 20%. So they bring people in, they give them bonuses, they transfer them in, and then they leave. So what's wrong with that model was part of what we started in trying to evaluate. And we came up with kind of an idea for grow your own strategy. And a grow your own was is that if we were able to offer an opportunity through scholarships, which, by the way, all the medical community is prepared to come forward to the table with their commitments, could we take students from community colleges in Southern Oregon, Rogue, SWOC, UCC, and be able to have these medical facilities choose an individual that they would then sponsor through this college and then have that person come back for clinical rotations and move home. Was that a possible way to flip that strategy of retention from 20% to maybe 80%? One of the other things that had never been really addressed was the VA. And so I reached out to Doug Paxson, who's the director, and I'm actually a veteran, and we went and met and started talking about the VA needs. They'd really never been taken into consideration in looking at what this college could potentially address. That path has led us down a really great opportunity with both the Office of Academic Partnership, the, I'm going to call it, Washington, D.C. kind of home office, and the conversations that we've had. They're struggling right now trying to find a way to get discharging people that are leaving the military so that they don't have to discharge, reapply to go into an academic program, leave that academic program, and then go back into the VA. And this number is in the thousands of people who want to work for just the VA, not just the people who want to enter the medical field. So their struggle was, how do they do that? And when we started talking with them, that's where a lot of this opportunity came up, was their response was, if you can figure out how to do that, we're in 100% support. How many seats do you have in your college? And we'd be prepared as a VA to be able to make a commitment. And they even went so far as to ask if they could have all the seats in our school. That's how serious they are about trying to fulfill this need of exiting military. And then add to that the actual VA, which I'll let you cover some of that, the actual requirements, which, by the way, almost overlapped perfectly with what we find in all of Southern Oregon. So the VA is really not an exception to the rule. It's really the same problem. and that they have retention problems as well. They can't recruit people into the area. Trying to find people that come from a metropolitan area and they move into a rural area, they don't necessarily like it all the time. So they end up leaving after that minimum time frame. So what we were able to do is put all this together into a program, and that's what we're here to present, is to try to ask for some support. There is some heavy lifting in this project because we still got to get a college built, and we're trying to find an academic partner right now. And that's kind of where we're at. I'm more than happy to answer any questions, but I didn't want to make it kind of not take too much time.
Thank you.
Honorable Chair, Committee, thank you for having me. My name is Barbara Galbraith. I am a retired Army reservist. I retired from the Army Corps. I did 21 years. I am an example of someone that entered the military, learned to drive trucks in the military through the Army, could drive a semi down I-5 without any problem, went to school to be a nurse, retired out of the Army Reserves. I'm coming here as the Associate Director for Patient Care Services. I'm offering an apology. Mr. Paxton actually had to go to central office, so when the big cheese calls, he has to go up there. So you have me as the second.
Calls to the principal's office.
Right, right. So our healthcare system is based out of Roseburg. We have a brand new, beautiful clinic in Eugene. If you ever get to Eugene, check it out. It's over by the Costco. It's a sight to be seen. We also have two clinics at the coast. We have one at North Bend and one in Brookings. We are very excited about this opportunity to have an allied health college. We really need to look at how do we grow our own in our community, as well as encourage veterans to pursue their military educational opportunities, which I was one of those people that did. I actually have my PhD as well as my MBA as well as an RN, so the military has treated me very well in my educational career. We are located, again, in central and southern Oregon. We actually have a portion of Northern California that's in our catchment area. We provide primary care and specialty care services to include medical, orthopedic, surgery, mental health. Primary care is our general focus. We have 29,000 veterans that we take care of, and in a year, we have 270,000 appointments that go through our system. Those are unique appointments. We continue to expand, especially in Eugene, because of that new clinic, and we do see a lot of actual veterans that retire to this beautiful state. So we get a lot of people that come here specifically to just enjoy the beautiful state of Oregon. We continue to grow, but at the same time, our current employee population, we're all close to retirement age, and especially nursing and allied health. We are struggling to keep enough staff to take care of our veterans, so we're very anxious to have this allied health. We have actually expanded again, as I mentioned. We have 126,000 square foot clinic in Eugene. It's a sight to be seen. And then we have a brand new 150,000 square foot hospital that we've expanded on within Roseburg. We've had to remodel. We are struggling with building a hospital within an old building. So we are actually putting up a new hospital. It may not happen while I'm still in the VA because it's in the central office level, but we have a new hospital that will also be built, and we have a brand new clinic that we're putting up in Brookings that we'll be getting keys to next week. So we have expanded in all different levels. We desperately need nurses, physicians, occupational health, speech therapy, lab techs, radiology techs, every variety you could have. We look forward to aligning ourselves with UCC Umpqua Community College because they are a feeder for us. They have a two-year program for nursing, but we really need to look at other opportunities because, as they've mentioned, people leave and explore those other opportunities because we just don't have that educational support. We are very excited to be part of this collaborative effort. And I want to mention that we have opportunities to actually send students into Washington. We have outreach into Washington, Alaska, and Idaho within our catchment area of VISN 20, which is a Veterans Integrated Network service. And we currently have over 35 educational affiliates.
Can I ask you to wrap up, please?
Sure. So I'm just very honored to be a veteran, to be able to speak to you all, and to promote this educational opportunity with the Allied Health.
Thank you both for driving up. I really appreciate your testimony, and you can watch Democracy in Action here in a moment.
Okay.
Thank you.
I'm going to close the public hearing on HB 3341 and open a work session on HB 3341. Representative Hayden.
Chair Greenlick, I move to adopt the -3 amendment dated 4/4/17.
Representative Hayden moves to adopt the -4 amendments?
Three
amendments dated
4/4.
Which
4/4/17.
341.
Is there any discussion on the amendments?
3341, I think.
Is there any objection?
No.
So moved. Representative Hayden?
Chair Greenlick, I move House Bill 3341 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation that the bill be referred to Ways and Means by prior reference.
Representative Hayden moves House Bill 3341 to the floor with a due pass as amended with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any discussion? Representative Hayden?
Thank you, Chair Greenlick. Thank you for bringing this very important bill. I see this as an opportunity to be innovative in Oregon again. We have worked diligently to have dual eligibility coming in our next waiver. I think there's an opportunity there with the coordinated care organizations, dual eligibility with Medicare and Medicaid. That opportunity is going to expand between now and 2019. I think it's critical that as your members come into this system, have that opportunity that you have the health care providers available in rural Oregon, particularly in the Allied Health, which is a very thinly spread. So I'm excited about this bill. I'm looking forward to having that move forward, and thank you for your time and dedication to bring that to us.
Thank you.
Any further discussion?
Alonzo Leon.
Representative Alonzo Leon.
Thank you, Chair. I also want to say that this is, I think, a great bill that supports segments of our population that need additional training or want to pursue their education. I think this is a great opportunity, and I really appreciate the partnerships that have been established to help that process move forward. So I'm really excited about this opportunity. So thank you to the representative for bringing this bill to us.
Thank you. Any further discussion? Can you please call the roll?
Representative Kenny Dyer.
Aye.
Representative Buehler.
Yes.
Representative Alonzo Leon.
Aye.
Representative Kennemer.
Aye.
Representative Maelstrom.
Aye.
Representative Hack.
Excuse.
Vice Chair Nose.
Yes.
Vice Chair Hayden.
Aye.
Chair Greenlee.
Aye. The motion carries. The bill is on its way to Ways and Means, and we'll keep an eye on it down there to get it moving again.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3292. Madam Administrator, what do we have there?
House Bill 3292 comes to you at the request of Representative Kennemer. This reinstates the tax credit for long-term care insurance premiums. There is a revenue statement, no fiscal impact, no amendments. This does have a subsequent referral to the House Committee on Revenue.
Would you call the witnesses?
Did you want to kick it off?
Mr. Chair, maybe I'll just say a couple words, if I may.
Okay, you want to sit from here? Yeah.
As a sponsor, and just from here, for the record, Bill Kennemer, State Rep, District 39. Just wanted to pass along this bill. I think I saw that this tax credit was going away and was very concerned about it. I think there were a lot of people of moderate income who have difficulties facing their future. And I noticed that when Sherry and I got married 19 years ago after both losing spouses, we were pretty conscious of how life can change your circumstances.
and we weren't quite sure what our nest egg was going to look like or if we were going to have one. And that was a time when we spent a lot of time considering this. And I think it's a very valid option and can often serve a critical purpose in sustaining people in those final years. And we have several experts who will talk more in depth about
this. I hope not too many.
And hopefully, no. I actually have, I think, one proponent and one opponent, don't I?
Would you call the witnesses, please?
Elise Brown and John Mullen.
See how you... I picked the easy ones first.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Elise Brown with America's Health Insurance Plans. America's Health Insurance Plans is the national trade association of health plans across the country, and here enthusiastically supporting House Bill 3292. I think many of us don't even think about the importance of long-term care insurance until we've been faced to in a position where we're taking care of family members. And I know that happened to me, and it's probably happened to every one of you or will happen to every one of you on the dais up there. And when you do, I went through that, and it was after that, taking care of my dad with dementia for a long period of time, my husband and I vowed that we would become purchasers of long-term care insurance. So let me just make a couple of comments to you. You do have some comments, lengthy comments, that have been submitted electronically from AHIP. So all I want to do is just highlight a couple things, and then I know that my friend John Mullen will respond in a different way. First, for long-term care, there are just a few options for financing long-term care. Private long-term care insurance is one option. Public programs are another, and that means Medicaid and Medicare. So Medicaid provides the assistance when the cost of care provides assistance with the cost of care, but Medicaid is not insurance. And it only works to help with long-term care for those who are poor, who have been or have become poor, paying for their care and loved ones. Let me share a couple of examples to you at the high cost people interface with today and why the long-term care insurance is important. These are 2016 costs. So median hourly cost for services of home health aid is $23 an hour, which adds up to about $65,000 a year. That's one example. Median cost for a year's stay in assisted living in private room in a nursing home in Oregon is $48,000. And so those are two examples just to share how expensive caring for your loved ones is. At the end of 2015, long-term care insurers paid over $107 million in benefits in Oregon and covered 86,400 residents. So what's the value for the state in considering, among many considerations this session, for extending the many tax credits that you have to decide on in this awful time of a dire budget that we have here facing us in Oregon? Long-term care insurance is effective in reducing Medicaid spend-down rates because it covers the majority of long-term care costs. So that's a savings for Oregon. Current policyholders are expected over their lifetime to save the Medicaid program $75 billion. So that's across the country. So again, we have challenges to consider in all the tax credits that will be extending or not extending. And if you all put a priority on affordability for a very important product that is expensive, I would suggest and I would hope that you would consider extending the tax credit so that we consider affordability and also not draining our Medicaid system for those who have to spend down and use it at some point, like my family had to do years ago. So those are my comments, Mr. Chair. Happy to answer questions after John's testimony.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, John Mullen here on behalf of the Human Services Coalition of Oregon. I have to admit off the top that this is a little awkward. I worked with Representative Kenemer back when he was Senator Kenemer and County Commissioner Kenemer, have a very good relationship. He knows of our work in long-term care when I was Director of Clackamas County Social Services. And my good friend Elise Brown and I are often on the same side of issues, but this time it's a little bit different. I want to point out why the Human Services Coalition supported the sunset of the long-term care insurance tax credit. A couple of things that are from the Department of Revenue report from 2015. You know that we break down income in terms of quintiles when the Department of Revenue looks at it. So for the bottom three quintiles, individuals between $0 and $46,400 accounted for 14% of the tax expenditures. And those filers had credits ranging from $12 to $180. For the top two revenue quintiles, individuals between $46,400 and those earning over $81,800 accounted for 86% of the tax expenditures and had credits ranging from $187 to $318 on average. So in the main, when we looked at this, it cost about $8 million to have this tax credit. So to Elise's point about the choices that you have to make this session, when the governor's recommended budget, for example, cuts Oregon Project Independence by 75%, $8 million would go a long way to providing direct long-term care assistance to people. This tax credit, in my opinion, is inefficient, and there was good reason to sunset it. And it's also a very highly unstable market. There are many articles out there about insurers that are dropped out of the program and spiking of premiums. And in defense of the industry, it's really very hard because if we look at Oregon here, the vast majority of people, 96% of those who were filers that took advantage of this credit were 52 years of age and older. So in other words, this is not a product that encourages younger people to get involved at an earlier stage in planning for the future. I'm very interested in talking at some point in time about insurance products that might be better for people, particularly to encourage lower income and also younger people to participate. But in my opinion, this is not the vehicle, and I would not be in favor of seeing this tax credit reinstated. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Are there any questions? Representative Buell, did you have?
Nope.
Representative Kindergarten. Yes, I have a comment, and I would be happy to step down there and give official testimony or just give it from here.
Brief.
Okay.
We'll just
I just want to say, as chair of the Human Services and Housing Committee, in 2015, we looked at all the tax credits that were sunsetting over 6 years. We looked at these really, really carefully. We dissected them. We read the history. We looked at all of those, and I remember the top, actually the top quartile was the one that was getting the most benefit from this. And we saw that the people that were at the bottom where there would, or in the middle, where there would actually be a potential of preventing the Medicaid spend down, because Medicaid spend down is not going to happen to the upper people. The people that you're talking about that, you know, might have to be drawing down their assets in order to qualify for Medicaid, those middle people were actually not purchasing this. And we, this was, I believe that we had all of the people in our committee decided very explicitly to sunset this particular tax credit, and I believe that Representatives Buehler and Hayden were with me on it. The only person I think who was not was Representative Parrish, and she was worried that we hadn't given enough notice, but we had actually on several different occasions in OLIS as well as public testimony, I called out, I said, if there's anyone from Elders in Action, if there's anyone from AARP, if there's anyone from HISCO, because this is serious to close off something that's been in place for a long time, any insurance, no one came forward and testified that we shouldn't be eliminating this. This is a really hard budget time. It was hard 2 years ago. It's even harder now.
And we want to make sure that when we're giving tax credit dollars, we're doing it for a real purpose. And if the purpose was really to help people save who would not otherwise be saving for this, that's one thing. But we've also heard some concerns about how the tax credit is used and how it's limited. And so I have been saying very openly over the last 2 years, if there's any other kind of product out there that we can offer that really help people that are low and moderate income, because I do think that we need to be concerned about moderate income people who might fall into the Medicaid spend down category, we need to work on that. And I reiterate that that pledge to consider that. But this was very, very thoroughly vetted 2 years ago with two fellow members on this committee who were also on that committee.
I'm trying to.
All right. Can we close it?
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. I'm going to close the public hearing on, where are we? On House Bill 3292. I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2301. What do we have, Madam Administrator?
Mr. Chair, House Bill 2301 came before the committee at the request of the Oregon Health Authority. We had a public hearing on the bill on February 8th. It's taken that long to get the amendments. This was the bill that separates out the health licensing office into two groups, health-related and trade professions, specifies circumstances under which the HLO is required or permitted to disclose the information obtained during an investigation. This is their omnibus bill. We have a -3 amendment before us, which allows physician assistants to treat allergic responses, clarifies the notice of intent and the Administrative Procedure Act process, and specifies that the information obtained from the investigation be provided to the person by the office. Also clarifies the registration requirement for the environmental health specialist and specifies that the state health officer or designee be a member of the Healthcare Acquired Infection Advisory Committee. We have, that is the -3 that's before us. We do have the fiscal and revenue on the -3. Fiscal is minimal and there is no revenue, Mr. Chair.
Okay, do we have a motion?
Mr. Chair, I would like to move that we adopt the -3 to House Bill 2301 dated March 23rd, 2017.
Representative moves the -3 to House Bill 2301 dated 3/23/17. Is there any discussion on the motion? Any objection? So moved.
Mr. Chair, I would like to move House Bill 2301 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Nose moves House Bill 2301 as amended with a -3 amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on the motion? Please call the roll.
Representative Kenny Dyer.
Aye.
Representative
Ewan. Yes.
Representative Alonzo.
Aye.
Representative Hennemann.
Aye.
Representative Maelstrom.
Aye.
Representative
Pack. Excuse.
Vice Chair
Nose?
Yes.
Vice Chair Haven?
Aye.
Chair
Greenland? Aye. Motion carries. Do we have a volunteer to carry it on the floor?
Representative Alonzo Leon, she smiled at me.
I'll take it.
Representative Alonzo Leon, we'll try and give you some help.
Thank you.
Close the work session on House Bill 2301. Open a work session on House Bill 2339. Administrator, what do we have?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2339 came before us at the request of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. This had a public hearing on February 13th. This bill prohibits non-participating facility-based providers and provider in emergency cases from balanced billing. It requires insurers to pay non-participating facility-based providers a reasonable and customary payment rate, and that the rate be based on statistically credible information that is updated at least annually. Mr. Chair, what we have before us is the -2 amendments, which adds the definition of provider and specifies that the reimbursement formula for non-participating providers for emergency and non-emergency services services be equals to 175% of the amount paid by Medicare. We do have the fiscal and the revenue on the -2s, Mr. Chair, which is a minimal fiscal and a no revenue.
The -2s came out of a sort of a task force agreement, and it's the one I would prefer, but I think we'll have a motion on an alternative as well.
And
yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move the dash four amendments, please.
Representative Mueller moves the dash four amendments to House Bill 2339. Okay. You want to lead the discussion here?
I think it's a sad day for the healthcare sector. We see this movement away from innovation and competition to price control, and innovation and competition are well-proven ways to control the escalation of healthcare costs, not only in this state but other places. And this is just one more step in that direction. On top of that, we're using a very political number as our price control reference, Medicare. The Dash 4 amendments is a much more reasonable reference point for these to prevent this problem.
Basically, this isn't about innovation and price fixing. It's just a question of which price. And I think I prefer the price in the Dash 2, and I would urge a no vote on the Dash 4. Any other discussion? Representative Hayden?
Thank you, Chair Greenlake. The Dash 4, which is dated 3/24/2017, I would prefer that we have that because it allows a group discussion on what those prices are. The problem is, and I think even most unions, private or public, would agree that if you put a price in front of a negotiating table that says if you don't come to an agreement, you're going to get X, it creates a very difficult environment for providers to be able to negotiate with those that are providing the contract. So I would be more in favor of Dr. Bueller's assessment in the Dash 4 amendment.
Any further discussion?
Thank you,
Mr. Chair. I would concur. I think Dash 4 is a fair option.
Would you call the roll, please?
Representative
Kennedy.
No. Representative
Buehler. Yes.
Representative
Alonzo Leon.
No.
Representative Kennemer.
Aye.
Representative
Kellmer. Aye.
Representative
Melstrom.
No.
Representative
Heck.
Excuse.
Vice Chair Nose.
No.
Vice Chair Hayden.
Yes.
Chair Greenlee.
No. That motion failed. Yeah. That was a strong yes. A strong yes vote.
Yes, it was. I had some skin in this game.
Mr. Chair, I would like to make a motion that the committee adopt the Dash 2s dated March 20th, 2017, to House Bill 2339.
Representative Nose moves the Dash 2 amendments dated 3/20/17 to House Bill 2339. Any discussion? Could you call the roll, please?
There's a discussion.
I'm sorry.
Representative Hayden wants another chance.
Representative Hayden. Thank you, Chair Greenlake. The Dash 2 is the one that sets the price at $175 of Medicaid, which I think is difficult for negotiations for providers to be able to provide the best service possible and to have the provider networks not be put at a disadvantage with the insurance company. Having said, I hope that the Senate side is able to take a look at this and come to a closer compromise that you, Chair Greenlake, had announced 2 days ago that we would have that at 125 instead of 175, which I felt was a compromise between the Dash 4 and 225, which was a compromise between the Dash 2s and the Dash 4s. And so I hope that the Senate side will take a serious look at either a compromise of a Dash 5 or something that doesn't put our providers that provide our health care at risk.
I always keep a little tube of ketchup around in case they have to eat my words. It's better to have them.
You are the chair.
I do want to point out that none of us are arguing about what the bill is trying to do. This is a situation where people pick a surgeon in network, pick a hospital in network, and then end up getting bills from pathology and radiology that were unexpected, and we're trying to do away with it. Everybody agrees we should. It's an argument about price, and there's a lot of valid positions on all sides of this. Would you call the roll, please, on the Dash 2 amendments?
Representative Kenny
Dyer.
Aye. Representative Buehler.
No.
Representative Alonzo Leon.
Aye.
Representative Kenneman.
No.
Representative Malmstrom.
Aye.
Representative Hack.
Excused.
Vice Chair Nose.
Yes.
Vice Chair Hayden.
No.
Chair Greenlee.
Aye. The motion carries. Dash 2 is in the bill. We have a motion on the bill as amended.
Mr. Chair, I would like to move House Bill 2339 to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation, including the dash 2s that we just adopted.
Representative Nose moves House Bill 2339 to the floor with a due pass recommendation as amended with the dash 2s. Is there any discussion on the motion? Would you please call the roll?
Representative Kenny Dyer.
Aye.
Representative Wheeler.
No.
Representative Alonzo Leon.
Aye.
Representative Kenema.
No.
Representative Maelstrom.
Aye.
Representative Hack.
Excuse.
Vice Chair Nose.
Yes.
Vice Chair Hayden.
No.
Chair Greenlee.
Aye. Motion carries. Representative Nose, will you carry this?
Yes.
Thank you very much.
I'll carry it for you.
Yeah, I'm sure you will.
I'll volunteer.
With a yes vote?
You're going to be glad you got the other one.
Okay.
I close the work session on House Bill 2339. We have one more work session we're going to hold, but we're holding that till toward the end of the meeting. But I will go back to the public hearing we have on House Bill 3418. I'm going to ask the witnesses on this bill and the next bill. We have two bills to cover and not a lot of time, so please be as brief as you possibly can. Would you call the first panel, please? On
I lost the list.
Sorry. Okay, we can't do that.
That's
bill.
Right.
She lost the list.
No, Mr. Chair. Sean Parkman, Freddie Scheinhauser, and Joe Basler.
Are there opponents, people?
Yes.
I'll do it.
Yeah.
We're going to call the pro and con on alternative panels. Any order, introduce yourself.
Chair Greenlee, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify. My name is Sean Parkman. I am a member of SAU 503, and I am the vice chair of the Public Employees Benefit Board. I am testifying today on behalf of SAU 503, and I'm here to testify in favor of House Bill 3418. PEBS hospital costs rose by 8.3% last year. Despite PEBS bargaining power, some hospital systems are charging our plans more than 300% of Medicare costs. Rising hospital costs are one of the main cost drivers that undermines PEBS' goals of keeping costs low. Meanwhile, Oregon hospitals' operating margins increased nearly 35%, indicating high profitability in 2014 and 2015, according to the Lund Report. Hospital systems would argue that due to a higher proportion of Oregonians covered by health insurance since the Affordable Care Act, hospitals have needed to provide less resources for charity care. Instead of taking their savings from this drop in charity care cases and invested that money back into Oregon communities in the form of community projects, they have pocketed much of the difference. One wonders how not-for-profit some of the not-for-profit hospitals are. The rate of increase that hospitals are forcing on PEB is unsustainable. A reasonable corrective action needed for this situation is House Bill 3418. This legislation would provide some much-needed leverage for PEB by providing a legislatively mandated cap on how much our fully insured and self-insured PEB plans can pay in-network providers and out-of-network providers. This applies to broader services than hospital costs, as it should, but it is hospital costs that are many services that are the services that are rising faster and are being reimbursed at rates above 200% and 185% of the rates for Medicare. PEB continues to be committed to using all means at its disposal to press for good deals with plans, providers, and hospitals. We have a good track record of finding success at holding costs down without simply pushing costs onto members. But it is becoming clear that there are some market distortions that are leading to price gouging. This legislation is a great answer to unsustainable health hospital costs. Thank you.
Thank you for being brief. Whoever.
Chair Greenlee, members of the committee, I'm Freddie Sennhauser, Vice President with All Care Health. We are a physician-led and physician-owned health plan in Grants Pass. We serve about 52,000-53,000 members. Oregon, we're an Oregon health plan provider. We have a Medicare Advantage plan. We have a supplemental program that covers the whole state of Oregon. And we're also a provider to the PET board. We insure more than 2,000 state employees in Southern Oregon, Jackson, Josephine, and Curry County, and the tiny sliver of Douglas County. About 4 years ago, when we replied to the RFP, part of the RFP was, of course, to become a successful bidder. We had to prove to the PET board that we had a viable network in place. In order for that network to be in place, we had to get provider contracts with physician organizations and, of course, with the hospitals. We approached the hospitals, the local hospitals, in particular the two large systems that we have in Southern Oregon, and we proposed to them to give us a better deal than what they're currently getting paid from PEB. Of course, we had to come up with a competitive rate to be in a position to get members. When we approached the hospitals and asked them for a direct contract, the hospitals were very eloquent, but in essence, the response was, what the heck, why would we do this? Because from day one, we would lose money serving your members. We did not get a direct contract with the local hospitals. We had to go outside, lease a network to have those hospitals in our system, a great expense to us. We today pay substantially more than what is in the bill, 3418. We pay substantially more than 200% to those hospitals. And with one particular hospital system, we still do not have a direct contract. We believe that if you adopt this bill or send it on to the legislator and the legislator adopts this bill, that will level the playing field so that small plans like ours can compete in Oregon. We have no aspirations to go north. We are perfectly happy in Southern Oregon, but we need a level playing field. We are not on the cutting edge of healthcare delivery. We are on the bleeding edge of healthcare delivery. We provide innovation. If you want innovation like you looked for under the Oregon Health Plan model a few years ago, we will deliver and we have delivered. We completely support what you have done with when you created the PAR and non-PAR on the Oregon Health Plan side, and we think that should be emulated for the PEP side too. The current program hurts the members it's actually supposed to serve, because without taking labor's position, you know that labor has bargained away salary and other benefits to get this really excellent health program, but something has to give. And I'm sorry to repeat myself, but we need a level playing field so that you can allow innovation and small plans to participate in this program. We know that the local delivery system works. We have grown our PET membership over the last 2+ years by 39%. And that is because we can do that at the local level and provide high-quality care. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Chair Greenlee, members of the committee, my name is Joe Basler. I work for Oregon AFSCME. I don't have a lot to add. I think Representative Kotek and my compatriots up here spoke very well. I would just say we represent about 10,000 state workers who there and their families are served by PEB, and we definitely need another tool to sort of put that cost containment. We've worked very, very hard the last few years to keep us at that 3.4% growth, and I think we've been very successful, but we're getting to the point where we need another tool to sort of keep us there. So that's it. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions this panel?
Yeah. Go ahead.
Hayden.
Representative Bueller.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Greenlee. Joe, how do your members' health care benefits compare value-wise to, say, our neighbor in the north and our neighbor to the south?
PEB is a great benefit. I will never pretend like it isn't significant. I think when you look at total compensation, I think we're actually right around the same place. We've, as mentioned, we have given up salary increases or taken pay freezes or no step increases to sort of maintain our health insurance and our value. That's been a choice we've made through the bargaining process. But it is a great system and is a great program, and we get a great benefit from it.
Follow up. My understanding is that your members' salaries are very comparable to the similar employees in Washington, but your members have very generous health care benefits. Is that not the case?
That's a good question. I would hate to be inaccurate. So if I can get back to you with that, I think what I've seen were about, in terms of private sector, not Washington, but private sector within Oregon, we're about 88% in terms of salary. But when it gets to total compensation, we're about equal. I don't want to be wrong. So can I get back to you with an answer on the state of Washington?
One more question, please. In the percentage of healthcare benefits that's picked up by your members compared to those in Washington, California, how do those compare?
Once again, I'm not 100% sure. Sorry, sir.
Really? Isn't this your job to negotiate these deals, contracts?
Chair Greenlake, Representative Buehler, I'm actually the political director, and I don't sit at the bargaining table and don't do the negotiation. And it is my I you're totally right. I'm incredibly embarrassed. I should know right off the top of my head, but I don't.
And you know the proportion that our members pay.
Yeah, 5%.
Yeah, our members pay 5%. It's the Washington
members. I'm sorry, Chair Greenlake, Representative Buehler. I should know Washington and California off the top of my head, but I don't, and I'm afraid I'll say something wrong. So,
you didn't read the article in the Register Guard on Sunday that covered this issue pretty extensively and in detail? You were quoted in it. Maybe you should take a look.
Oh, God. Representative Buehler. Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Chair Greenlake. Mr. Senhauer, or any of you, this is looking at one side of the equation. If in our public health benefits, for example, myself, as a health care provider, I provided health care for my employees, and I got elected to this wonderful position called state legislator. And I was able to stay basically with the same insurance company with almost identical plan as far as benefits. But the premium the state pays for me is about 30% more than what my private insurance company was able to negotiate. So without any additional benefit to me, the insurance that's being provided is about 30% more cost. Would you agree or disagree with the concept of looking at if our schools, higher education, different departments within our public employees were able to go onto that free market that I was able to negotiate with before I came here, we could have a significant cost savings. Would you disagree with having a discussion about both sides of the equation?
I would probably disagree with that statement. I think because the state of Oregon, with 136,000 members, has certainly a lot of bargaining power, negotiating power. I would, really emphasize the point that the way the current system is set up, where in essence hospitals can just increase their charge master, at will, so to speak, or negotiate rates that are maybe not in the state's interest, we're not served.
We're going to have to move on. Mm-hmm. We've got too many people coming. I'll be glad to have that discussion with you in a work session, but I think the difference is the risk profile of the two populations that are different. But let's go on. We have several more witnesses, and we have another bill.
Hans Notenboom, Chris Strier, Courtney Dresser. And then Elise, you're on deck.
Please go ahead.
Oh. Come on up. I'm not sure who left that.
Chair Greenlake and committee members, thanks for having me today. My name is Hans Notenboom. I'm a physician that works out of Eugene, Oregon. I'm the president of the Oregon chapter of the American College of Emergency Physicians. We have been representing emergency specialty care in this state since 1971 and are committed to the emergent health care of citizens throughout Oregon. We would like to say that I will try to be brief so I can allow my colleagues time.
I'm going to ask the witnesses to hold the 2 minutes.
Please. Yeah, I'll try to be quick. I would just like to say that we are speaking in opposition to 3418 as written, primarily because of the issue of using Medicare as the rate that we are basing our numbers off, which we think is flawed. I'll start off by saying that, as we've heard earlier, I think that Medicare is a politically derived number based on federal budgets and is mainly built to make a number to take care of elderly and disabled patients in our country. Over the years, the Medicare rates have not even upheld or stayed, kept pace with inflation rates as we've gone forward. As a result of that, those rates are not really based on any market value and are not meant to be based on market value. Therefore, when we start basing rates such as PEB reimbursement, we are using an artificial number. The risk of that is, as we go forward, the negotiation power with physicians, for example, is that such that there's no incentive necessarily for insurance companies to negotiate to try and keep people in network because there's a much lower rate at the Medicare rates. In addition to that, we put access at risk for patients as these are the providers that are the safety net for the state of Oregon. We take care of nearly the entire indigent population of the state. In addition to that, we take care of about two-thirds of the Medicare population of this state. We have to provide for disaster care, surge capacity, boarding, and staffing for surges. These are all things that we have to account for so that we are ready to prepare for the best care in the state of Oregon for any disasters or any other things that might happen. As a result of that, our margins are not the same as people who have a choice in what care they provide. We are people that are held to the EMTALA laws and guidelines, and as a result, this is a bill that could be very difficult for those providers and hospitals, especially in areas that might be at more risk, and could result in the loss of providers or call panels. So, like Speaker Kotek said, I think we would agree that we think a transparent system is good, but Medicare as the basis for that is something that we think is flawed. And as opposed to that, we would say that we would rather support something that would be more in line with an independent database that we could use to create that transparency rather than an artificial number that's not based on market value. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Chairman Greenlake and members of the committee, thank you for letting us speak. My name is Chris Strier. I'm an emergency physician at Emmanuel Hospital, and I am the director of revenue cycle management for our physician practice group, which is a group of about 100 or 115 emergency providers. We're the largest independent emergency physician group in the state. We take care of about 250,000 patients a year. And I wanted to just very briefly add a couple of thoughts to the notion of tying provider reimbursement to Medicare. My colleague mentioned that it hasn't kept pace with inflation. If all you did was take the original Medicare reimbursement rate, which was set 25 years ago, if all you did was adjust that for inflation over those 25 years and you made no other changes to it, the Medicare reimbursement rate for providers now would probably be about 80% higher than what it currently is. And that's for general inflation. If you made that adjustment for medical inflation, it would be considerably higher than that. People have spoken about the importance of the triple aims and maintaining the triple aims, and I think that's fantastic. I don't think there's a provider around who wouldn't be a big cheerleader for triple aims, but I think there's an assumption that if all you do is lower costs of what you're paying the provider, if what you're doing is you're artificially keeping those rates very low, you may satisfy one arm of the triple aims with cost containment, at least in the short term, but what you do is you run the risk of sacrificing the other two arms, which is population health and patient experience, because if the rate is set too low and if providers feel like they have no leverage in negotiating contracts, and these contracts are what supplement our ability to take care of low-pay and non-pay Medicare, Medicaid, indigent patients, if you hamstring that ability, the call panels for emergency care will be severely compromised, and when patients need care, especially emergency care, that may not be available. Even now in the state where I work, we are routinely taking transfers from other hospitals, sometimes that come by fixed wings, because what to us would be a relatively straightforward problem, in the emergency room where that patient presented initially, they can't find anyone to take care of them. And so please keep that in mind. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair, members of the committee. Courtney Dresser with the Oregon Medical Association. I think the physicians at the table here spoke very wisely of this issue. We all agree, and I think at the OMA agree with the goal of kind of trying to figure out ways to lower healthcare costs and lower the cost of delivery of care. But I think the concern that I would like to address is just kind of how putting Medicare rate into statute at any percentage is concerning with the unintended consequences of the negotiation table between healthcare insurers and providers. It makes for a very unfair table and could possibly lead to more people being out of network than in network and having some more access issues. So as it would just be easier for some insurers to step away from the table and because the cost would be a lower amount than the commercial rate that they would have to pay. So it's that's our concern is that putting something like this could slowly trickle down into our insurance tables, and we would have some unintended consequences down the line. Thank you.
Thank you. We have one more witness. Would you call the witness?
Elise Brown.
Thank you very much. Briefly, Elise.
Hello again, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Elise Brown for America's Health Insurance Plans, and I will be extra special brief. In fact, let me just start with saying that the speaker is absolutely right to look at ways to reduce the cost of PEB, and we totally support that. However, House Bill 3418 does not solve that problem, and we'd like to continue to work with her and have the conversations that need to be had in a collaborative way. And it was great to actually follow the providers just now. Many of the comments I was going to make are really identical to the points they just made, so I won't bring that back up. I do know, and AHIP has experience in working on these issues across the country, but there are examples of other state plans, Oregon State Benefits plans, who are partnering with their corresponding carriers in unique ways, and would love to learn more about that and share that with the speaker as we continue to have this discussion. So I wanted to really end with that and thank you and assure you that we are interested and want to continue talking about
it. Thank you very much. I'm going to close the work session. The public hearing on House Bill 3418 and open the public hearing on House Bill 3355. Madam Administrator, what do we have?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this bill is before us at the request of Representative Kenemer. It authorizes the State Board of Psychologist Examiners to issue a certificate of prescriptive authority to licensed psychologist who meets the specified requirements, creates a seven-member committee on prescribing psychologists, declares an emergency effective on passage. You have a -2 amendment, Mr. Chair, that I believe that they will be speaking to. And want me to call the first
Mr.
panel?
Mr. Kenemer,
may I speak? Just a couple of words?
Go ahead.
Thank you. For the record, Dr. former Senator and State Representative Bill Kenemer.
Professor.
We are on the -2 amendments. A couple of things about that. I don't usually use the title doctor, but I practiced for 35 years. And in full disclosure, my six-year PhD program, I crammed into 7. Yeah, it was a grueling experience, but a good one. And a couple of things that were critical in here is I spent a year's clerkship at USC Medical Center, where I worked especially with chronically mentally ill and prescribed frequently under the authority of a very outstanding psychiatrist, and learned a lot about medications and their importance and potential. Also did an internship at Vancouver Mental Health, and again worked closely with the psychiatrist there. I found in my practice that I was referred a lot of patients by physicians, many of whom were GPs and often not experts in psychotropic medication. And I see where there would be great value in, while what I realize is that a lot of those needed to be adjusted, and it was sometimes difficult to work with them. In fact, they would put me in an ethical situation, difficult ethical situation, since I didn't have prescribing rights. A couple of other things. Part of that state senator and rep discussion was in the Senate, and you heard a little tirade on Monday. We began talking about the integration of mental health with physical health and actually supposedly put it into law. And then again in 2009, we worked here in the House. I worked on that with talking about parity. I think this is a huge step forward. This committee and the legislature have been progressive with PAs and nurse practitioners prescribing, and there's a shortage of mental health prescribers at this point in time. I think this is another good alternative. And I want to say a special shout out to Dr. Senator Steiner Hayward, who is my chief co-sponsor of this bill, and a thank you to the four members of this committee who joined me as co-sponsors on the bill. I'm looking forward to some great testimony as we talk about this very important matter.
Great, great, but brief, I hope. I'm going to announce we're carrying over, we're rescheduling the work session on House Bill 2645 for Monday coming, so we won't be opening that. Madam Administrator?
She stepped out.
She disappeared.
She stepped out.
Where's I don't know where that was. That her?
There's a list.
He's gone. Where's everybody gone? Let's call the first panel. Call the first three.
But we need the advocates first.
Tanya Tompkin. Sandy Bumpkus.
She's against this.
I'm sorry. Here. You
call your witnesses. You
well, we called the wrong ones first. I apologize.
Just kidding.
Let me ask. I have some people here who would be. Just panel come forward, please. So, for three. What?
First panel, let Ann.
Yeah, thank you. Let's just move down.
Okay.
Then we'll get Sandy back and get some order in this.
Sorry about that.
Dallas McKay and Lindsay.
Please be brief.
Chair Greenlich, members of the committee, thank you so much for the opportunity to testify. My name is Carolyn Ellis, and I'm a psychologist in Waldport, Oregon, in our lovely little town of 2000 and growing. I have been a psychologist in Waldport for about 2 years now, serving the community of Lincoln County on the Central Oregon coast. I'm asking for your support in House Bill 3355. Our local county mental health currently has a 6 to 9 month wait list for a prescribing provider. And when someone presents to them requesting a prescription, they are immediately directed to our urgent care where they are prescribed medication by an on-call doc. I can tell you we have a profound mental health need in our community, and we are fighting an ever uphill battle trying to meet that need. Most of our prescriptions for any type of psychiatric care are given by our primary care physicians or our urgent care docs. While they are doing their absolute best to stem the tide of a significant mental health needs, they don't quite understand the same diagnostic importance between mental health diagnoses that we do. Quite often I just see the generic anxiety with depression. And the reason that that's important is there are significant differences between things like bipolar and unipolar depression, as well as there are diagnoses like post-traumatic stress disorder and anxiety disorders that share a lot of symptoms of other disorders like ADHD. Often our physicians will well-intentioned prescribe something like an SSRI antidepressant for bipolar depression, which has been known to induce mania and can cause horrific side effects for patients. I've also witnessed well-intentioned providers prescribe a medication for ADHD when the patient told them they were having difficulty with attention that caused them to have a profound panic attack upon returning home because the real diagnosis was post-traumatic stress disorder. So this is a very important thing, understanding diagnostic clarification. I have nothing but the deepest and most profound respect for psychiatric prescribers. I have worked with many within and without my organization who are phenomenal. I know that they are also aware and feel the burden of prescribing in the state of Oregon. I know that they've made attempts to do telepsychiatry, chart reviews, and try and fill that need. And even then, the closest option we have for psychiatric prescribing within my organization is in Corvallis, which is a 3-hour round trip. And even then, they are 6 months out right now if a patient has an immediate need. So again, the ER and the urgent care docs are prescribing their medications. Even with chart reviews, they'll send a chart review to one of our PCPs and on recommending medications, and the PCPs do not have the time nor the understanding of taper instructions, and will just say, forget this, I'll give them a whole pill, tell them to take half the first week. Side effects are so profound, the patient will discontinue the medication.
Can I actually wrap up, please?
Absolutely. I recognize the need for comprehensive education. I am currently a member of an APA-designated program. I attend real-time classes for clinical psychopharmacology. I was just in class last night. I attend live lectures, ask questions of the professor. These are desktop delivery that are always live presentation. As a primary care psychologist, and more importantly, as a rural health care provider, I'm asking for your support, and I'm asking on behalf of the greater than 50% of Oregon psychologists surveyed by the OPA who are also in favor of RXP. Thank you.
Thank you.
So I'm going to introduce, this is Faylene McKay.
They can introduce themselves.
Oh, okay. So you go ahead.
Okay. Hi, my name is Faylene McKay, and I'm here to support HB 3355. My son Tyler, daughter, and I all needed some psychiatric care in the last several years, and there's been nothing in Lincoln County. I have not gotten in with a prescribing doctor in Lincoln County at all. This is an ongoing problem. My son has a complicated diagnosis. Excuse me, I get nervous. I've had to take him. I've had to take time off of work and take Tyler out of school several times to drive to another county to get him the appropriate mental health or make appointments to another county for mental health. In the meantime, I had to stop because the danger outweighed the appointments.
Take a deep breath. We're here for you.
I would explain to the psychologist and the psychiatrist that I got to see one time of Tyler's outburst and his violent behavior towards me. They just stared at me. I was afraid for both of our safeties as well as the other drivers out there, not knowing what his behavior was going to be like. While trying to get myself and my son help, the school called the truancy office on me. Having Dr. Ellis in our community has been a huge help to myself and my children. If she could prescribe medication, it would make a bigger difference for my family and all the other people in my community. I highly recommend people getting more education, degrees, or whatever they need to meet the needs of our community. I did it for myself. I was a bartender with OHP insurance and could not get Tyler help from anybody. I tried to get him into the FSA clinic at OHSU, but they denied me because of my insurance. My community is desperate, as well as myself. I hope you will allow Dr. Ellis and other people like her to get the education, training, and become prescribers to meet the needs of others like ours.
Thank you so much for sharing your story.
Thank you.
Hello, I'm Dr. Linnea Lindsay. I'm a primary care psychologist from Eugene, Oregon, and I'm here today to testify in support of House Bill 3355. For 16 years, I practiced in the Hood River area, where we, for 7 years, did not have a psychiatric prescriber. Myself and one of my colleagues decided we were compelled to go and get an education, and we pursued the postdoctorate Master's of Science in Clinical Psychopharmacology, knowing there was not prescriptive authority at the time, but knowing that our community and our peers really needed our help in healthcare as we practiced together. This model for education and training that's set up within the bill is sound and practical. I know this because I have done it. Despite knowing that there was not prescriptive authority within our state, in 2009, I set up with a colleague of mine in Corvallis a model of care. We were trying to ascertain what the right didactic model would be post the degree. For 3 months, I practiced within the psychiatric program, and we discerned after that that I really didn't need the training of a psychiatric resident. My competency, my training, and my clinical skill set was more than that. What I needed was elbow-to-elbow, day-to-day medical practice. So I went and practiced in the family medicine residency clinic across the driveway. I practiced with my colleagues there, learning about lab values, physical assessment, learned about shared ER charts, curbside consults, being able to do warm handoffs. We built our competency together. My primary care practitioner colleagues were so grateful every day to have my presence there, the presence that allowed them to not send patients to the emergency department or to other places of care where they might be delayed in their care or languish for a long period of time. We were also able to affect the wait lists of the psychiatric prescribers in specialty care. We were able to reduce their wait lists by up to 50%. This is an effective population healthcare delivery model where there is stratification and the most complex comorbid patients with mental health care could get into a psychiatric physician when they needed to without delay, and I was able to treat in collaboration with my primary care colleagues the moderate or mildly mentally ill who needed care. I wholeheartedly support this work. It is something that is necessary within the cost of care change and healthcare reform. The training and
please wrap up your testimony.
Yes, the training and the model that we propose here is to be exclusively in a shared, collaborative medical setting and to meet the needs of Oregonians today.
Thank you very much. Could you call the next panel, please?
Okay, Tanya Tompkins, Sandy Bumpus, and Megan Holney, Coffney.
Chair Greenlick and honorable members of the House Healthcare Committee. My name is Tanya Tompkins. I'm from McMinnville, Oregon. I'm here today to testify in opposition to House Bill 3355. I hold a PhD in clinical psychology from UCLA and trained in the Neuropsychiatric Institute there. I've been a professor of psychology at Linfield College since 2002, and I recently conducted a study of Oregon psychologists to try and understand what they know and think about this issue of prescriptive authority for psychologists. And my results were published in a peer-reviewed article this past fall. I'm an educator, and I'm one of a large number of professional psychologists who do oppose prescriptive authority for psychologists as proposed. I've also submitted separate testimony on behalf of an organization in which I belong, Psychologists Opposed to Prescriptive Authority for Psychologists. As a researcher and educator, my heart goes out to both the practitioners who are wanting to provide care, as well as the mother who cannot get adequate care for her child. But these are systemic issues that will not be impacted by a law that allows shortcut training to psychologists who are well-trained in psychosocial treatments and interventions, in biopsychosocial causes of disorders, but not in in biological treatments for disorders. And I'm frankly disappointed to see that the bill from 2010 that Governor Kulongoski vetoed has been substantially unchanged. And in fact, I have two main concerns, but also concern about the structure of the bill, which allows an oversight committee of four psychologists, three physicians, which will determine whether some of my concerns about competency and safety are either amplified or minimized. That is, we don't know anything about formulary. Residency training, she talked about some model that has been proposed. But yet, if you look at the bill, there's no indication of the number of hours that are are required, the number of length of time that a person has to complete that training in, whether they're doing it part-time or full-time, how many patients they need to see. None of that is stipulated. All of that, including formulary, continuing ed, whether they can take this multiple-choice exam after the MS in clinical psychopharm, is something that is all going to be decided after you vote on this bill. No other state has taken a similar approach, and I would argue it's completely unacceptable to vote on something where you cannot ascertain some of these important issues which speak to competency and safety. So my two main concerns. Psychologist training in a biopsychosocial basis of behavior doesn't provide an adequate foundation. You don't have to have any biology background as an undergraduate to go into and earn your doctorate. You also have no gatekeeping mechanisms for the Emerson Clinical Psychopharm programs either. So you can have no neurochemistry, and yet mostly distance ed, but sometimes in class, learn about pathophysiology with no anatomy and physiology. You can learn about neurochemistry, but never having taken in a class in chemistry. As an educator, that actually perplexes me. And I would argue that it's concerning to not recognize bounds of competence. And so those are my issues in terms of concerns about education. And I'm often folks who are opposed to these types of bills are seen as being alarmist. And yet I've shared with the committee, and I ask you to take a look at them, several lawsuits which have led to hospitalization of prescribers not engaging in safe and competent care. And I would argue that we would not like to see Oregonians that are vulnerable.
Representative Kenner, do you have a comment?
I do. I have a couple of questions.
Yes.
Are you licensed as a psychologist in the state of Oregon?
I'm an educator and I'm a community preventionist.
Yes. Have you practiced as a licensed professional psychologist?
I am not a licensed psychologist.
I just think that's important that you're commenting on a profession without any experience. And have you read the Dash-2 amendments thoroughly, and do you understand
I
them?
I have only seen one.
That's what
amendment.
I thought, because your testimony was not germane to what the bill is about. Excuse me.
Representative Kenner, I saw last night, I looked to see if there were any amendments, and the only amendment that I saw posted online was Dash-2, which changed accredited to designated, and that's an issue I've raised with many of you. Many of these bills are boilerplate.
Yes, please.
Thank you, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Sandy Bumpus, and I'm a parent. And before I go into my testimony, I just want to say that I was really compelled by the parent who just spoke on the last panel. This is a very challenging issue, especially for families who have young children. And I came here today to say that I'm opposed to this bill as written for a few reasons. But I also want to agree with the parent who spoke to say getting the kind of help that families need for their children is very, very difficult. And so we recognize that, and we know that there need to be some solutions. However, in my experience, I had a child who was on psychiatric medications at a very young age. And our path in this realm began at the age of 3 with my child. And over the course of time, the symptoms that she had became worse, and by the time we got the ability to see a child psychiatrist, we had several different diagnoses on the table. We had 2 different medications that were tried initially with no success and with some significant side effects, and this is in my testimony, so I'm not going to read through all of it. But I think the biggest concern for me at that point in time was that I had a very sweet, innocent, bubbly child who all of a sudden became a child who was very withdrawn, had major headaches nearly every day after starting the medication.
Are you speaking specifically to this bill?
Yes. Yes, I am. And I'm speaking, my concern is, as a parent, trying to get psychiatric care for your child, I want to make sure that whoever is prescribing that medication is practicing at the highest level of competence around psychopharmacology.
We all care about that. I think we agree with you on that.
To skip forward, I think number one, there is an important distinction that a lot of psychiatrists, or I'm not just going to use psychiatrists, I'm going to say anybody who's working in the field of children's mental health system, who understand well that children are not the same as adults. They are, and that their brain is still developing, as we all know. And it is comforting to know as a parent that my child can get treatment from a licensed medical professional who understands this and understands when it might make sense to take a calculated risk in prescribing a medication or not. Knowing that close observation and lab testing, along with observing changes in behavior, are critical to ensuring a healthy outcome. As a parent, we need to know that those who are making decisions regarding medication know what positive impact the treatment can have, as well as potential side effects. In our case, we had to rely on a doctor who understood how to provide the medical treatment that would ameliorate the negative symptoms.
Can I ask you to wrap up your testimony, please?
Yes, and I will do so, and I want, there's a couple more points I'd like to make.
Very quickly, please.
You know, I guess instead of going further, I feel like it's clear that it feels to me like the response coming back from this committee feels like there's a lot of support on the other side of this bill. And so what I want to say is that Dr. Ajit Jetmalani, who works for the state of Oregon and has a lot of respect, has proposed some strategies that I think I'd like to encourage the committee to look at. And I'm hopeful that maybe there's a way for the two sides of this argument around whether to prescribe psychologists or not, can that his comments can actually find some opportunities to take another look at it. I don't feel, as the bill is written, that I would feel comfortable as a parent in having a psychologist. And I'm not talking about the psychologist that spoke today. Obviously, there are those who do excellent practice. But
could I ask you to wrap up?
My last statement is, we all know that, you know, that's not true in every case. So that's the end of my comments.
Thank you.
Chair Greenlee, members of the committee, my name is Megan Cahay. I reside in District 46 in Portland, Oregon. I'm Senior Director for Peer and Wellness Services at Cascadia Behavioral Healthcare. For the last 40 years, I've taken psychiatric medications. I was diagnosed with schizophrenia, depression, anxiety, insomnia. And I just want to say that these drugs are profound. The side effects are huge. And they include akathisia, where you feel like you want to jump out of your skin, drooling, tremors, pseudoparkinsonism, galactorrhea, where both women and men have prolactin levels, which is what a mother has raised when she's nursing. Men and women can lactate even though they're not nursing. The list of negative side effects is huge, and every drug has side effects, even something as common as Prozac or Xanax. These are very serious drugs. I certainly want for myself and for my peers to have as much safety and protection as possible. The bill as written does not provide me with any assurance that this would be the case. What I think we need is access to alternatives, and I think psychologists are in a great position to provide some of the alternatives to prescribing medication. If we just go with medication, it's not going to be good care, and I just am very fearful for the people that I serve and for myself. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Would you call the next panel, please?
Paul Geiger, Holly Jo Hodges, Morgan Sammons.
Yes, I got it.
Yes,
okay. Please introduce yourself.
Chair, members of the committee. My name's Paul Geiger. I'm a psychiatrist. I work at Providence Health System. I'm the regional medical director for behavioral health for Oregon. I'm here to support the bill and communicate that Providence is supporting the bill as well. Just want to run through a couple of quick points. There's obviously a shortage of psychiatric providers. I think that's been very clearly articulated. There are a number of factors that contribute to access to psychiatric treatment and evaluation in Oregon beyond just the number of psychiatrists and psychiatric nurse practitioners, including barriers related to system structures and payers. Providing care within a medical home is a way to expand access to psychiatric care and psychiatric prescribing. Looking at this bill, extending the skill set of psychologists, I support. Psychologists have years in training, diagnosing, and treating mental illness. I have a lot of interaction with them in our system. We have over 30 psychologists working in primary care. I've been impressed with their ability to assess patients, make diagnosis, create a clinical formulation, and I believe that enabling them to take a next step to provide medication would be quite possible and safely done. I think that the most important element of psychiatric treatment is diagnosis, and most of the problems that I've seen in cases that don't go right start with an incorrect diagnosis, and with excellent training in diagnostic skills, I think psychologists would do well in this arena. And I'm particularly comforted by the fact that this bill provides, requires a connection with a medical setting. There are a lot of concerns about safety with this practice, and because the bill requires direct collaboration with a medical setting, I think concerns around monitoring patients that need laboratory monitoring or management of comorbid medical problems, this bill will do that safely, and I think that's a strength of the bill. I think if you look at the usual practice, if a psychiatrist is working with a patient in the community and they're concerned about a medical issue, typically the response is to refer to primary care. And so I don't see why a similar type of a process couldn't occur here in a safe manner. So just to sum up, I think that this is a way to meet an overwhelming need. I'm the primary recruiter for our group. We have over 30 psychiatrists. I'm on the phone every week recruiting people from all over the country. It's very difficult to land people, and I know that our primary care system with over 400 providers are really struggling to get people in time. So thank you for your consideration of this bill. I'd be happy to answer questions.
Hi. I'm Holly Jo Hodges. I'm a family medicine physician, and I currently live in Eugene. I'm here to testify of my support of House Bill 3355. I'm a native Oregonian, and I have practiced clinical medicine in Central Oregon and have been a medical director at the Coordinated Care Organization in Lane County, and I'm currently working as a medical director for WVP Health Authority here in Salem. I also serve on the Oregon Health Authority's Quality Health Outcomes Committee, as well as being a governor-appointed commissioner on the Health Evidence Review Commission. I've graduated from medical school here in Oregon and have practiced here my whole life. I speak today as a family physician and not representing my company. In the more than two decades that I have practiced medicine, I have never had a consistent ability to refer my patients to a psychiatric physician colleague. Whether I've been in rural Central Oregon in my 16 years in the community of Prineville or in more substantial cities of Eugene or Salem, access to care for a patient requiring a psychiatric prescriber can be so delayed as to be practically non-existent, especially for children. This left the responsibility to me as the primary care physician. Primary care physicians are currently the de facto prescribers for these issues in our country. We begrudgingly write nearly 80% of all mental health prescriptions despite being minimally trained in diagnosing mental health disorders and much less in treating or prescribing for mental health conditions. I see the lack of mental health care for the poor and the elderly on a daily basis. My current position provides medical management for an insurance company, the membership of which is 94,000 Medicaid and 10,000 Medicare members. And finding providers is unbelievably difficult. A February 2017 article in the Psychiatric Times titled "A Crisis in the Public Service Psychiatric Workforce" was co-authored by our Oregon colleague, Dr. David Pollock, a psychiatrist. The summary paragraph from that article states it very well. The data seem to show that there are not enough psychiatrists to treat the demand, and of those that are in the workforce, many are unwilling, unable, or unqualified to work with the public sector patients. Moreover, the uptake of new psychiatric providers into the system is at risk of not keeping up with the retirement rate of older psychiatric providers and the increasing demand for service based on the population and demographic data. We know that by 2020, we're going to have a shortage of approximately 40% of psychiatric physicians and 20% of primary care physicians when compared to the projected needs of our population. As we face increasing shortages, we must develop an increased competency of our healthcare team members.
Can you wrap up, please?
Yep. House Bill 3355 does just that by adding to the skill set of our doctoral trained clinical psychologists. With the targeted education that is proposed, the psychologists can practice in medical settings alongside the primary care physicians to help alleviate the dire need for appropriate diagnosing and prescribing of medications for patients with unmet mental health needs. I'd just like to say that Dr. Linnea Lindsay is far better trained at diagnosis and prescribing than I ever was in any of my training or 21 years of clinical practice. I would feel completely comfortable having her at my side. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you. Yes, please. Oh, we have two more.
Okay. Please be brief. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Morgan Sammons. I'm a psychologist. I'm the executive officer of the National Register of Health Service Psychologists. I'm also an Oregon native, born in Walport, raised in Ashland, and where I also have a home. I have been a prescribing psychologist for many, many years. I'm a graduate of the Department of Defense Psychopharmacology Demonstration Project. I then completed a naval career, during which time I prescribed psychotropic medications throughout that career. And I can assure you that the training that is encompassed in this bill is sufficient to, with the kind of collaborative care that Dr. Geiger has just described to you, ensure that you will have the highest quality, best trained providers of psychotropic medication that we can afford with this legislation. It is sound. It is based on legislation that has now passed in 5 other states. Last night, the governor of Idaho signed a bill enabling psychologists appropriately trained in that state to prescribe prescriptive psychotropic medications. So New Mexico, Louisiana, Illinois, Iowa, Idaho, and now perhaps Oregon, along with the territory of Guam, the DOD, and various branches of the public health service, namely the Indian Health Service, all allow appropriately trained psychologists to prescribe. So we used to be called, back in the 1990s, I used to be called an experiment. but I think at this point, I can call myself an innovation. And I believe that this is innovative care that will meet the needs of many, many Oregonians, and I think it will do so safely and will dramatically increase access to sorely needed mental health care in this state. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your testimony.
Mr. Chair, if I could.
Quickly, please.
Thank you. A couple of things. Dr. Geiger, I want to thank you as a psychiatrist for coming. I think that's very nice thing to do, and I appreciate your standing with Providence. It's been interesting. Dr. Hodges talked about the upcoming shortage. Well, it's actually here, according to Providence, and I think we need that. Dr. Sammons, you talked, there was an allegation that the training was very inadequate. I think, first of all, we have typically 5 years of postgraduate training. To become a psychologist.
We're way over here. We've got two more witnesses.
Yeah, and I'll just one more moment, please. And there's a very extensive chart that's available in the materials that you can look at that verifies this is an extensive training program. These people will be well-supervised and very competent. Thank you.
Thank you very much for coming. Would you please follow the last witness? William. I'm sorry, committee, we're way over, but...
Yeah.
Let's finish up.
William Dalton and John Betlinski.
Got it.
Thank you.
And you're all standing between us and adjournment.
Mr. Chair.
I solemnly swear, sir, to do this in less than 3 minutes.
low pressure.
My name is Dr. John Belinsky, and I am the president-elect of the Oregon Psychiatric Physicians Association. OPPA, as you know, is a district branch of the American Psychiatric Association and was established in 1966, serves as the organization for psychiatrists in Oregon, working together to ensure humane care and effective treatment for persons with mental illness, including substance use disorders, and compassion for their families. Here in Oregon, not everyone who needs quality mental health care has access to appropriate care. OPPA applauds our legislators for recognizing and seeking to address this issue, and OPPA opposes House Bill 3355, which would allow psychologists to prescribe drugs in the medical setting. Passage of the bill as written would put patients at risk by allowing people with inadequate medical training to prescribe powerful psychotropic medications to some of Oregon's most vulnerable patients. First, not only does House Bill 3355 create a new category of practitioners, the prescribing psychologist, but by definition it also creates a new category of patient, the patient who can be prescribed drugs by a professional with minimal medical training. Most psychiatric medications have serious side effects and risks, even risks that can lead to death and permanent disability. Many psychiatric conditions are also easily confused with other medical illnesses with similar presentations. Two, we risk further stigmatization of patients with mental illness by making them the only patients who will receive medical treatment by practitioners who have not been trained in the complex ways in which the body functions. Second, Provision 12 of House Bill 3355 declares an emergency in order for the immediate preservation of public peace, health, and safety. Yet in its current form, House Bill 355 does not account for several safety standards of basic medical practice. Those who engage in such fundamentally medical approach as prescription of medications ought to be subject to a board steeped in the medical model. Those who prescribe medications need to provide 24-hour coverage for their patients. House Bill 3355 requires neither of these, nor does it require prescribing psychologists to participate in Oregon's Health Professional Services Program. In short, if safety is our goal, no practitioner should be allowed to prescribe drugs unless they have met and continue to meet all of the educational and clinical training requirements and professional obligations of other non-physician medical professions that currently have the authority to write prescriptions, such as physician assistant and nurse practitioners. Third, House Bill 3355 doesn't expand access. What it does do is take mental health professionals from one underserved area, assessment and therapy, and grant them the ability to practice in another underserved area, prescription of medications. In so doing, it masks the real problem that not all patients in the mental health arena have access to appropriate care. How can access be improved? Well, in addition to our state's coordinated care organizations, several practice trends are already in place and increasing in number and will provide regular access to psychiatric expertise in primary care clinics without sacrificing a deep general medical understanding of the patient. OPAL-K provides same-day child psychiatric phone consultation to primary care providers in Oregon at no cost to them. Project ECHO provides psychiatric education and case discussion for PCPs, also at no cost to them. Funding could expand both of these programs to include adults and the whole state of Oregon. Funding a new program in Oregon to train train physician assistants in psychiatric prescribing would also extend access without sacrificing basic medical knowledge. Further, the Ames Center, based out of the University of Washington, has developed a program to expand primary care to include behavioral health treatment from psychiatrists efficiently and effectively. Multiple studies show evidence of improved patient care, improved outcomes, and decreased cost. The Oregon Psychiatric Physicians Association and partners have led or participated in all of these initiatives, and we urge legislators to pursue only strategies that have been proven to increase access to quality mental health care. OPPA remains eager to support and assist in the implementation of these strategies, and if the legislature decides to go forward with House Bill 3355, the OPPA respectfully asks to be part of the effort to carefully develop amendments establishing basic patient safety protections, including appropriate regulatory oversight for Oregon's mental health patients that are on par with protections every other Oregonian has in the medical setting. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. I'd be pleased to answer questions.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
I'm William Dalton, and I've got a migraine headache, so I'm sorry I'm not as articulate as I'd like to be. Maybe that's the excuse this time anyway. I'm a doctoral psychologist, 30 years administering programs largely in rural areas, former administrator of Phenomia, Oregon, and important to me and at least I think relevant to what we're sharing here, a consumer of mental health services all of my adult life. Fortunately, I've received excellent care. In rural areas, I really relate to what the lady from Walport said. I fought for 13 years to get a psychiatrist into Southern Oregon when I headed up the mental health program in Josephine County. If you think it's tough sitting in Providence Hospital trying to recruit psychiatrists, try sitting in Grants Pass, Oregon, trying to recruit psychiatrists. It was only through OHSU and their excellent outreach and innovative program for rural psychiatrists that we were even able to access the very basic of needs. I'm in a peculiar position today in that I agree with just about everything that's been said at this table. And I think you're in both the best of worlds and the worst of worlds having to make a decision about this bill, because people will be up here and absolutely disagree or absolutely love the bill. And the truth is, they've, at least in my experience, what I've read and heard from the people I reached out to before I prepared my testimony and in the opportunity to listen today, I find myself saying, amen. There is a tremendous problem with access. We have some excellent examples of programs that are able to take non-physicians and enable them to really provide significant assistance, particularly in our rural areas. Representative Dr. Kennemer, I think, reflected very well the kind of program that we can embrace even as a consumer, as well as a mental health program provider, with enthusiasm, a way of expanding our very limited resource base. But I think we would be of disservice to ourselves, partially because of the testimony this gentleman made. We don't want to just thin the soup. We want to truly add to the resource base. And I think there are some structural issues that may be within the purview of the legislature. Not sure whether they're within the purview of this committee itself. We need to provide enhancements to get people going into the field of medicine to want to go into psychiatry, and for general practitioners to get as much education as possible about psychotropic medication. I have just mentioned the two least remunerated classes of physicians, at least in the United States, and I find that very, very sad. A second thing that we need to do is, as we put additional providers into the field, like well-trained clinical psychologists who meet our basic guidelines, we need to make sure that they have access to those people who have the best of training and the best of knowledge and the best of experience. The kind of clinical settings that we've heard about from, including Representative Kennemer, are the best ones that we could absolutely want to have. So please try and address these issues. Telemedicine, the average reimbursement for a psychiatrist providing consultation through telemedicine is approximately $19. You're not going to get a great deal of enthusiasm from your professionals.
We have to ask you, we've got, it turns out, another meeting coming
into
the room.
That's the end of my testimony. I'm going to go home and take care of my headache.
I'm sorry about your headache.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
When we end up with the thing that everybody's right, then what we do is count votes at that point.
Excellent. Thank you so much for the opportunity.
I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3355. We are adjourned. Thank you for your 355. We are adjourned. Thank you.